Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Thank you for joining us. Today on the podcast, you've got me, finally wrapping up my Paramita series. And I know, I really dragged this series out, but today we're doing the final, the ultimate Paramita, Prajna, the perfection of wisdom. What is it? How is it supposed to work for us? And can we get access to at least a little of it? And don't worry, if you're not caught up on all these Paramita series podcasts, I'm pretty sure that's the whole point. But also, the rest of the episodes from the series are all posted up on the website, or wherever you hear these, so you can go back and find those if you want. But this one was a nice one to wrap up on because this whole Paramita series was kind of the end of my Buddhist basics kick I was on last year, where I focused on the more definable, intelligible Buddhist theories that might even help us to be happier and nicer people, maybe even better people if that's a thing, you know, the light side of Buddhism. And this year has been focusing more on the dark side of Zen, the more subtle, mysterious, nebulous, profound that doesn't like to be pinned down so easy. And this one is kind of the perfect bridge between those. So I hope you enjoy. But hey, speaking of light and dark, a huge shout out to everyone out there donating to help keep the lights on over here at ACZC. We are 100% small donor funded and could not do it without you. Thank you so much. If you'd like to join them and help keep a little center running and keep these podcasts going, you can go over to aczc.org/donate, make a one-time donation, or even better, become a recurring member at whatever level you can afford. And if you cannot afford to donate, please do not. Thank you for hanging out and being part of our community. But if you can, please do. That's how we can afford to keep this free and accessible for everyone. That's our system. It almost kind of works out most of the time, and that's all we could ever wish for. So anyway, thank you for being, thank you for everything you do is the point. And okay, enough out of me. Here you go. On with the show. Here is me with Fuck Around and Find Out. All right. Hi, everybody. Happy Monday. Today, we're finishing the Paramita series. I've been doing this series for a month or two now. The podcast got sidetracked, but did each of the Paramitas in order, and we are now on the final one, Wisdom. This talk will either be really helpful or very redundant. I'm not sure which. You tell me later. If you haven't been there for them, don't worry. You can catch up easy. I've been following this book. This is Dale Wright's book called The Six Perfections. The six Paramitas are kind of Mahayana Buddhism's, I don't know. Originally, the idea of the series was it's the things that, you know, what is a Buddha or what is an enlightened person? I wanted to like make that sound more practical. So it's like, oh, these six things are what they have classically said equals that. A Buddha perfected these six things. There you go, demystified. That was kind of the idea of the series. And we went through the first five, which I memorized earlier. I finally remembered them. They were, sorry, generosity, morality, patience, energy, meditation. And then the reason we don't usually hear about those much in Zen is because usually we only focus on the last one, Prajna, which you've probably heard that word if you've been here for any length of time. We chant it every Friday and every month at the well-being ceremony in the Heart Sutra. And so Zen has always had a habit of saying, and this is going to tell us about that too, that if you just focus on wisdom, all the other virtues will fall in line with that. And then in fact, focusing on the other virtues first or even kind of explicitly can be counterproductive unless you really get prajna, wisdom. And if you don't get prajna, it can be counterproductive to focus on the other five. And if you do really get prajna, you've probably already mastered the other five. So problem solved. That's kind of the theory as I understand it. Oh, wait, I started the talk. I was supposed to start with a koan. Here's a koan. So pretend it's a cold open. All right, back to cold open. One day, while Zhao Zhou is off on his travels, oh, and for this koan, just the characters, Tazi is a character, and he's going to be a hermit who's somehow he's fairly well known, but he's still like a lonely hermit in a small hermitage. That's his story, but he's a famous one and well respected. And Zhao Zhou is going to become famous later in life, but Zhao Zhou is in his wandering phase. Zhao Zhou is an old man, somewhere between 50 and 80 in this. He starts his teaching career at 80 and lives to be 120, so he gets very famous later. But this is during his wandering period. So at this point, Zhao Zhou is probably older than Tazi, but he's a nobody, and Tazi is a famous hermitage teacher. That's the deal. One day, while Zhao Zhou was off on his travels, Tazi also happened to be traveling nearby. They passed along the road but didn't recognize each other. Zhao Zhou discreetly asked a local about the man and was told it was Tazi. So Zhao Zhou caught up with him and asked, "Aren't you the master of Mount Tazi?" And Tazi said, "Spare a coin for tea and salt." Zhao Zhou immediately left for Tazi's hermitage and sat down to wait for him. Eventually, Tawzi came back carrying a flask of oil, and Zhao Zhou said, "I've heard so much about the great Tawzi, and all I see here is an old man hawking oil." And Tawzi said, "You see an old man hawking oil, but you don't know anything about Tawzi." And Zhao Zhou said, "What is Tawzi?" Tawzi said, "Oily." And Zhao Zhou asked, "What if the dead come back to life?" Tawzi said, "Never go by night. Better to wait for the daylight." Zhao Zhou said, "I thought I was bad, but you're a badass." There you go, that's your story. I know. Don't worry. That's the point. That's the point. That last line, that's my way of rendering. They end a lot of koans with, "I thought I wore the white hat, but you wear the black." There's an old folktale apparently about a robber who's named Marquis White or wears a white hat. I can't understand the translations. This is what I'm told. And they're both robbers, but the black-hatted robber robs the white-hatted robber. So it's always a way of saying, you're a rebel, you're a thief, but you're the thief who thieves from the thieves. You're the guy who robs the robbers, so you're more badass. So I always render it as, "I thought I was bad, but you're a badass." I think that works for English. Anyway, that's what that was. They didn't actually say badass in Chinese. But so, yeah, this one's kind of baffling. This is like, we did this last week, and everyone's like, yeah, this is the most koan-y of koans. It just seems like some random stuff. It seems like it's snappy, but what is it even talking about? And even if you do break it down, so it can be broken down into, like, definable teaching. Really, the meat of the koan starts at the end when Zhao Zhou asks him, "What if the dead come back to life?" This koan book we've been doing, it's been kind of going in order, I think, in a certain order of its own. It's well edited. It's a curated collection. And if I'm understanding it right, in my literary analysis of it, the last few were kind of coming about the difficulty of approaching something like enlightenment. There are a couple about enlightenment itself. And then this one is, "What if the dead come back to life?" So it's kind of a way of asking, when everything's fallen away, and then you have to go and function and be a person again, what about that? How does that work out? And Tawzi says, "Never go by night, better wait for the daylight." Light and dark are always common metaphors in this. One thing I like about this literature is that darkness, we always, you know, we grew up in a culture where light and dark, light is good, dark is bad. And what I liked when I first found, especially, you know, Chinese philosophy, when I first started reading the Tao Te Ching, was darkness was a good thing. It was the subtle, the delicate, the fine, the small. They had like the small dark light. And I was like, oh, I like that. That makes sense. It's a quiet kind of wisdom, a quiet truth. But anyway, so darkness isn't a bad thing. And so that's why this one is even funny. So he's saying, no, do it in broad daylight. I'm not quite sure what he's saying. We can unpack that later. But whatever it is, it's as opposed to in the darkness, don't keep it small. Keep this one not hidden. And yet a few koans ago, they were definitely saying, no, it's the small, it's the dark, it's the hidden. And so even when they're giving you an answer, it's always, it's not going to be consistent. That's why I started you with this koan. Because that's how they do wisdom. So hopefully we're going to talk about why are we like this? Why are koans like this? Why is this stuff written like this? All right, so back to wisdom. Back to prajna. So, yeah, it's supposedly the culmination of all of them, of all the six paramitas, but also the one that if you understand it, it informs the rest of them. One thing they say is that it's something that's understood more in terms of a way of being rather than in view. So it's not something that you learn. And again, this is where it might sound redundant to everything we talked about here before, but you don't learn it as an idea, although we are going to finally get the idea. It's something that you kind of demonstrate. It's a show don't tell thing. And they say that there is a view that leads to wisdom. And there is a view that they would call wisdom, but the view is not the wisdom. But the view can get you there, according to Dale Wright. The thing I like about Dale Wright is, I've been saying this every time in this book, he's an academic, he's not a Zen teacher, and so he's a lot more straightforward in his way of explaining things than a good Zen teacher would be, which sometimes is refreshing. Anyway, so there is a view that will get you to ultimate wisdom. And I was like, oh, I was so excited. I was like, oh my God, they're finally going to tell us. What's the answer? There's an answer. Here's the answer. Are you ready? It's actually an answer. Emptiness. But you knew that. You've heard that before. I know. I was like, oh, it's going to happen. Oh, that's, I knew that. I forgot they were going to say that. And I got so excited for an answer. Anyway, so, but what do they mean by emptiness? According to Dale Wright, it's the capacity to work with and envision the emptiness of all things. He says, emptiness is a universal predicate in the Buddhist tradition, a claim about all claims, a view about all views, a position with respect to all positions you might hold. So it's the big one. But really, what they mean, and this goes back to all Buddhism, is that something lacks its own sense of self. It lacks, they say, own being. It lacks, it's not self-generated. It's not self-possessed. The word that came through China was it doesn't have self-nature. Eventually, we think things that are static things that exist on their own. A bookshelf is a bookshelf. A person is a person. I am a me. And to say things are empty isn't denying they exist. It's just saying that nothing exists in and of itself. Nothing comes into existence by itself. Nothing stays static. Everything is always in flux, interdependent on other things, and can't be pinned down to being any one thing. And that's what they mean by emptiness. So that's why it's not, we always swear to God we're not talking about nihilism when we talk about emptiness. That's what they mean. They drill it into your head because our idea of things existing is as static, separate entities. And they just want to really like beat that out of our brains. Like that's the mistake. That's always the mistake, is things are static. I'm trying to think of an example. I'm in LA, so traffic. My question is, who do we blame for traffic? You know, you're sitting in your car, and me, my first thing is, hey, I don't want to be in a car. Hate cars. You guys know that. So then I might blame, first it's either the idiot drivers in front of me who are separate from me in their separate cars. And then if I want to be forgiving and have compassion for them, I'll blame the system. I'll blame oil companies. I'll blame some conglomerates in the 1950s who ruined the public transit in Los Angeles. I can blame all kinds of things for why this traffic that's outside of me shouldn't exist and I know better. When the truth is, I'm traffic. I'm in a car on the road. I'm as much part of this as everything else. And this thing, whatever cause this has causes, it existed long before whoever I want to find to blame that caused this come into existence, of which I was a part, which also gave birth to me and my attitude and reactions in it. So how do I react to traffic? If I get angry, if I figure out who I can blame for it and then drive in such a manner, I might cut somebody off and or act in a certain way on there, which is going to piss off them. It's just going to go spiraling around. So you're creating the future as your, you know, product of it. Like there's no point where you can say, that was me in a traffic. It's like, no. Traffic is a thing that is of all things. So yeah, it's based on all that Buddhist ideas. Impermanence, dependent arising, no self. Do we know codependent arising? This is one thing that I always get from early Buddhism that I think is critical to really understanding what we're doing here, that I think gets lost in a lot of the Zen literature. But codependent arising, it's just that all things, when we talk about the five skandhas or the things that make you, that everything comes into existence at the same time because of each other. It's always a house of cards. If you take away any one thing, situation wouldn't exist. This room wouldn't exist without each of you in it the way it is. It would not be this room if you weren't here. This room came into being with you here. Does that make sense? Like the room wasn't this room before you? Oh, that just sounds like poetry, but that's the idea. So the Prajnaparamita literature is the thing that happens in Buddhism sometime, probably around the year 0 to 200 AD, for sure. It could have happened well before. They're not quite sure from the, trying to read the literature. But the Prajnaparamita literature is the literature obsessed with emptiness. And that's what all of Mahayana and then especially Zen becomes based off. So the Heart Sutra that we chant, like the major chant, is the most condensed version of Prajnaparamita literature. There's all kinds of Prajnaparamita literatures. There's one, I think 120,000 lines is the longest one. I haven't read that one. That's too long. There's 80,000 lines. I think there's 60,000 lines. The Diamond Sutra is a lot less lines. The Heart Sutra is pretty condensed. And the Tibetans is my favorite thing. They condensed it down to the Prajnaparamita literature in one syllable. Good job, Tibetans. I believe it was A. So there you go. Now you know. Sometimes Buddhism feels like a Douglas Adams joke to me. And I feel like the Prajnaparamita literature in one syllable. That's funny. But they're extended meditations on all the implications of making emptiness the crux to everything. And there's a lot of implications to that, a lot of ironic implications, if you notice. That's why I did that a koan that was kind of funny, but mostly baffling, because when you start playing this out, it gets weird. So firstly, the idea that everything is always contextual and always in motion. When people were doing the Jukai and the precepts, some people were frustrated with the idea that they'll come to a spiritual center And the priest will have them take vows to be good people, and they will ask reasonable questions like, how should I follow this vow? And they'll get back a jerk answer like, I can't tell you that, that's up to you. They're like, but. And it's like, yeah, no, we don't do fixed views. We cannot tell you what it means to speak truth or to not lie. You know, only you know that, which can be frustrating. But as I was taught in school, you know, they're giving you a lot in this one, which is that just like everything, your vows to be a good person, our commandments here are always context and time dependent. And if you're doing it right, you can't know until the moment happens how to follow that. Because anything else, we're just telling you to make it feel better. Because the truth is everything's always changing. We don't know that situation is what the best thing to do in that situation is. And I love to have found a tradition that will admit that. Because I feel like most traditions know that. They just don't trust you enough to say that. And so where it gets all ironic and weird, so first, the precepts are undefinable. And then this is where the whole thing gets silly. Emptiness itself is a concept. This is also a teaching. Just like the other paramitas, this is a concept, this is a teaching. And so to even say that we understand this, that's saying you have a fixed view, you now understand. Contrary to the entire spirit, you're not demonstrating what we're trying to say. And so showing us that you understand emptiness is not demonstrating emptiness. And so that's why Zen is bizarre. Because somehow you have to show that you're here, you're present, you're honest, you're not being a jerk, but also you're not clinging to any one thing to prove that. And so you see why it gets weird. But to put it in real terms, to me what these means, because emptiness can sound very philosophical, non-duality sounds very philosophical, and this thing sounds like all sutra-y stuff. So how I understand this in myself is it's really just saying an open and flexible mind. It's not saying to believe in it. It's not saying we're nihilists. It's not saying not to have opinions or personality. It's just playfulness, curiosity. What I always notice myself the most is not having the need to defend my sense of identity and self. That's like a big kind of tell that I'm clinging to some kind of attachment to a fixed view that may or may not be changing at the moment. Is what am I defending here, usually in an ego way, you know? What do I feel is at stake? And not as a problem, because that's the other thing too, is this is never something, it's not a one and done. You never get to have finished this. And so to me, it's always continuous. Like I'm always gonna notice a time when I'm like, oh, that's fun. I have a little identity thing there that I was like really kind of clinging to that I thought was pretty cool. Like, oh, I thought I was being a good priest. And you find out you're not. And you're like, okay. There you go. that can be really helpful. Sarah and I were talking. I think we came down to the phrase of the day was fuck around and find out. That's what emptiness means. Anyway, back to the book. So the techniques are Mahayana traditions, Prajnaparamita, sutras recommend the practices, meditating on emptiness. So like we talked about last time, instead of traditional forms of meditation where you focus on specific insight and concentration practices, you notice that, as we always talk about, we don't teach that. We teach just sitting. It's a complete embodiment of how to meditate on emptiness. When we say, don't try to focus on any one thing, don't try to have a goal, that's actually theoretically saying, meditate on emptiness, please. You know, because you're practicing the idea of letting things go loose, not needing to cling to anything. Not needing to know what you're doing is getting comfortable with what emptiness feels like. And that's what we're asking of you when you come here. They say, if you want a more definable term, see how things arise, change, and disappear. If you do that for long enough, eventually that cultivates non-attachment because you notice that anything you want to cling to, it was going to change and go away anyway, so what were you always defending? And you notice that so much of our lives is about trying to defend things that were just going to change and go away anyway. And it's like, well, I guess I can relax. That's old Buddhism. The innovation of Mahayana and the Prajnaparamita literature and Zen is that they turned around and then were really focused on applying that to Buddhism and the practice itself. Some might say a little bit too focused on that, but I can see why, or actually I wonder why. This is a Dave theory, this is a Dave hot take, why I do Buddhism. My theory is that of all the practices in the world, this one really works. I haven't seen so many other traditions that have so many safeguards and concerns about how well it's gonna work for you. I see more other traditions trying to like push you into something new and grand and wonderful, and I always see really honest Buddhist things being like, careful, Careful. That's gonna work. So it's really hard to know the history of pre-Chinese Buddhism that well. It's been very mythologized, but mostly it was just historically wiped out when Buddhism faded away in India. So we have histories from China in text. We have histories from Japan in text that we can read. There isn't a lot of the written history in India, just got wiped out and lost. But the impression that I get, knowing history, how things usually work, and what it seems like the characters are doing at the time, is that this Mahayana stuff seems to be a corrective to monks getting very high and mighty about their attainments and probably attaining a lot of prestige and having a lot of, like, well, a lot of religions have a lot of hypocrisies around well-to-do monks walking around not owning things in some very nice temple palace complexes that they seem to have exclusive control over. This kind of thing happens a lot. And we know that, Ashoka made Buddhism the imperial religion of India in 300 BC, 200 BC, something like that. And then that's when you see the Mahayana literature pop up, making fun of the idea of thinking that you're enlightened, making fun of attainments being anything to venerate and things like that. So I don't know, that's kind of a one way to look at it. But like I talked about, I think in one of my last talks with my own story, is that I kept encountering this whenever I would do intentional, focused practices designed to cultivate actual virtues in kind of non-Zen ways. They always worked. You know, like I would find myself transformed. I would find myself feeling better, being nicer, being great, but I could never stop. Maybe it's just me. Your results may vary, but I could never stop. There's always an ego creep on that. There's always this line where I was conscious of how much better I was becoming. And that always limited me. It always became kind of a problem. So I went into this cycle of like, things would improve, jump in the shark, things would fall apart. Things would improve, jump in the sharp, things would fall apart. And so I came across Zen and found all these like, careful. Yes, it's going to work, but don't get proud. And I was like, okay, no, this is helpful. This is, and I found a much kind of smoother, funnier path with myself since then, where you can kind of like, see how things are working on a daily basis and without, but having that kind of constant corrective of not getting too excited about it, which I know is a lot of, it's a damper. Imagine you're trying to run a Zen center for a living and trying to pay the bills, and your whole job is to offer something that you know can improve everything. And yet, you know, if you sell it like that, you're going to ruin the entire thing. And you know, if you sell it like that, you could probably put a lot more butts in seats and probably get a lot more donations. And you sit there telling people like, yeah, don't get excited. You know, it's not a great marketing pitch, but it's the only way to do it honestly and sustainably. And so that's my job. How's yours? Trying to downsell something that you know is amazing constantly and watching that kind of work and people get frustrated and leave. You're like, well, I'm sorry. That's the best I can do. And the hope is that people stick around and fuck around and find out for themselves. So that kind of leads to, I think, getting close to the end on this part of it. One last concept with it, groundlessness. So, something that's often described is, Wright says, whenever practitioners want something solid and secure to stand on, the mental rug is pulled out from under their feet. No ultimate foundation is offered because this kind of spiritual training is intended more to raise transformative questions than to provide easy answers. So again, kind of like with the precept example, people come to a spiritual center, want to be told how to behave like a good person, and we just would not do that, and people got upset, and some didn't want to do it. Totally fair. But like, that's an expected part. I like having these things because it tells me as a facilitator, no, that's supposed to happen. Not everyone's going to be on board, and that doesn't mean you're doing it wrong if people get upset when you don't give clear answers. That's just how it kind of has to be to do it right. Because groundlessness, and that's where they go on to say, it's supposed to be scary. It's supposed to be uncomfortable. A lot of the sutras really go into like, no, this is a terrifying teaching. Like, they really don't make any small bones about it. So if you feel kind of frustrated with the way we talk around here, don't worry. They know that here's a Prajna Paramita Sutra. Will not bodhisattvas who have newly set out on the quest for wisdom become apprehensive and regretful when they hear this exposition? Will they not tremble, be frightened, be terrified? In response, the Buddha agrees without being bothered by their prospects. They will tremble, be frightened, be terrified if newly set out on the quest. They course in perfect wisdom while still unskilled in means, or if they have gotten into the hands of a good spiritual friend that is master teacher. So yes, it's supposed to be terrifying. Tanya gave a great talk on spiritual bypassing. And I was talking to somebody else about it later, and we came up with a shorthand. Is it bypass or bodhi? I like when things are alliterations. I remember alliterations. So the question is, so if you don't know spiritual bypassing, I believe that will come out before this one. Maybe not. Just in case. Spiritual bypassing is when you use spiritual things to try to tell yourself that you're feeling better, or try to make yourself feel comfortable about things you shouldn't be feeling comfortable about. Does that make sense? If you're depressed, let's say, and you say, well, my problems don't matter because everything is empty and I'm not a person anyway, so my problems aren't real. That's spiritual bypassing. That's just ignoring your life by trying to use Buddhist teachings. Anyway, but sometimes the same thing can be either enlightening and letting go, or they can be a way to deny yourself and keep yourself ignorant of certain things you don't want to know. And so the question becomes, is this a bypass or Bodhi? And you never really know the answer, again, like everything, because it's all kind of groundless. And so that's where I know we're saying it's frightening, it's groundless, and it's supposed to be uncomfortable. But I also want to kind of put it in here, because I don't think Wright really goes into it. He skipped the whole thing about thusness. So we have emptiness, and then you have thusness. And it's always the corollary. Emptiness means nothing is static, nothing can be said to exist. Thusness is, no, everything is right here. Just this is it. That's thusness. And it's a positive way of saying the same thing of emptiness. Like, it's not something else. It's not a label. It's this, an intimate reality with this, you know? And so in the more positive aspect, like, yes, groundlessness and not giving you things to cling to can be frightening and can be off-putting and upsetting. It's supposed to be. But also, we talk about balance and contentment. And these are the words that we would use. We're not trying to make you happy. We're not trying to make you proud. No one's trying to instill confidence. All confidence can help. Confidence can be part of it, actually. But we do talk about balance, contentment, you know, these kind of things. Again, back to like the dark, the smaller, the quieter, the delicate things. Those are the ways that you know peace here. Yeah. Anyway, what I like about all this, what drew me to this, is that what this makes for, and I think that was a kind of a founding ideal of this sangha, or kind of characteristic of the sangha, is that it makes kind of a punk rock think for yourself spirituality. And Wright says, the willingness to probe dimensions of experience that we normally just assume without question. This is the capacity to ask real questions. Repeatedly, the sutras admonish those who fail to inquire, who want to be told rather than to think themselves. So again, like, when you encounter a place that won't tell you how to be a good person, how to do right from wrong, that can be off-putting. But also, I don't know, again, I grew up in the 90s, and the rules were different in the 90s. do we trust institutions and authority again? I feel like bucking authority in institutions was cooler before the year 2000. I could be wrong about that. Correct me. People younger than me. Right? You kids respect authority too much. But then I find Zen where they're like, yeah, no, don't trust us. Find out for yourself. I'm like, thank you. That's what I was looking for out of an institution. So, but also, again, it does make it hard. I'm just complaining about my job now. But what we're asking for, and especially as like part of this Ongo thing coming up, we're going to be doing some of the focus is on passing off to a shared stewardship model of other people coming and taking over. And I am a little nervous because part of it is that, you know, fuck around and find out also means we're asking people to, no, think for yourselves. Be a little unruly. Challenge what we tell you. Challenge what I think I know about my job that I'm trying to pass off to a committee of people who may or may not get along, which is what I was told. It's what all the old teachings say. But it's highly inconvenient because, you know, 8 people in a room thinking for themselves can A, take up a lot of time, and B, it's just kind of a different model. But I like that they trust us with that. And that will always be the model going forward. I hope everybody knows if we start dealing with more practical things like running the centering committees and stuff, like it's always a practice thing. I think I'm going to make a speech at the next meeting about that, where it's like, there's kind of a Zen, well, if I've learned Zen properly at all, and I can be corrected, but from what I understand, this unruly question things, think for yourself thing is very much a part of the tradition. And yet, the other part is tradition. Learn by example. Do things the way they've always been done. Don't bring your ego into it and do things the way you want them to be done. And what I've learned from my training in Japan and with Gyokei has often been a model where, and I was told this is a specifically cultural thing when I was at Toshoji, is that there's a threefold system to mastery. First, you just mimic and you do things the way they've always been done because that's the right way to do them. No questions. Learn it exactly. Once you get good at that, you realize, wait a minute, this doesn't cover all the bases. There are some flaws in this model that don't actually apply. And even if I followed it exactly, it's not going to answer all of the questions I'm going to have about how things work. Then you have to like start playing around and finding out. So you learn that the system's flawed eventually. And then once you've kind of mastered that and you can work within things and you could do your own thing while still following along and not breaking rules, but also realizing the rules were never the point, Then you do whatever you want. Nobody cares. Nobody respects you anyway. That's kind of the system of mastery, as I was told at Ato Shoji. And I think that it kind of accounts for this. And I hope if we can do anything with this passing off a shared stewardship model of the center, it would be kind of hopefully in that vein. Like, you know, I've been doing a lot of things kind of independently for many years now. And I guess this is my wrap-up speech. I was going to tell stories. These are my stories. Fun. Even better. So yeah, for many years, I've been doing things kind of... Well, that's the thing. Okay, yeah. Important talk. So the misnomer would be that I just kind of did things the way I wanted to. That is not what happened. I was given a lot of autonomy here, and a lot of people were not checking up on me for a lot of the time. But what actually, like, the way this place was designed was that when I was commissioned, what happened was Brett asked me out to dinner. We went out to dinner. And, okay, sorry. Let's tell this as a story. I did a series of podcasts where I told the story of like how I got the money to come out here and start a new life as a monk. So pretend all that happened. I somehow got money and I'm here. But what happened was when I was back in Nashville running my old businesses before I got to leave, and I was having a hard time. That's the short version of the stories. Brad wrote a blog talking about how he wanted to start the Angel City Zen Center. And I was laying in a dish pit. my life is going to shit. I read this blog, you know, at night laying on some rubber mats. And I'm like, if there's any way in the world I can get out there and be part of that, I want to do that. So I made the whole plan to go to grad school. I was going to become a chaplain was the idea. And I just kind of wanted to be around and see what happened with the center. And so when I got here, I was the biggest donor to their fundraising campaign for that. The campaign was funny because they wrote a business plan to raise $96,000 on paper, $96,000, $45,000 a year caretaker. I was like, that all sounds super cool. But then I read the business plan. I was like, this is just making shit up that doesn't have any base in reality. Anyway, so the fundraiser raised 25 grand. And the problem with 25 grand asking for 96 is it's too little to not do anything, but it's not close to enough to do what you said you were going to do. So what do you do? And what we did do was the board, who I was not involved with at the time, just got in a bunch of infighting. Nothing happened. Everyone got frustrated. People were kind of falling off. And I kept pestering Brad. Brad, are you doing a center? Brad, you're doing a center? What's going to happen? Brad, are you doing a center? Somebody called me out to dinner and he's like, okay, if you want a center to happen, he's in his words, we don't know how to do things, apparently. You know how to do things because I had businesses before. He's seen me run my businesses. Will you do this for us? And I was like, you don't know what that means to you. He's like, no, I don't. I was like, okay, fine. I will do this for you. And then I just got lucky. I looked so good. Because I don't know what they were doing, but I just looked on Zillow. I found the first house I found, said it was zoned residential and commercial. It was affordable. It had a big enough living room. And I was like, guess how about this? Like, oh, that'll work. And so we just got a residential place with the first place I showed them and it worked out. And I looked pretty good, but I just made one phone call. It wasn't. So then the center started and I was just kind of like, sort of kind of left in charge. What Brad did is he then went away on tour for 3 months and said, good luck, open while I'm gone, I'll see you when I'm back, don't fuck it up. And the night before he left, he wrote me a 5-page report of things that didn't make sense of how a Zen Center is supposed to be run. He gave me some contacts for other people from Tassajara that we knew. And the idea was that, so I never did anything of my own ideas. I had experience from UCLA, I had experience from Nashville, I had friends, and I had Brad's weird instructions. And I was always trying to figure out what a Zen Center was supposed to be. Looking back, we did a lot of innovative things, or kind of like our own weird whole style, but that was never the intention. We were just trying to do the right thing according to the tradition in the house that we had with the people that we had. And that's how things are supposed to go. And then for 7 years, I just kind of did stuff, always trying to do the right thing, not what I wanted to do. And I'm sure that's often very confusing. I probably didn't always live up to that, you know. But that's what I would want to pass on, is that, like, when we're having this committee meetings, I've been in a lot of committees, a lot of activist projects, a lot of idealistic projects, and the death of any, if you guys have ever been anarchists, I don't know if you've ever been anarchists, but the death of every consensus meeting is that everyone's got an opinion, everyone thinks they're very important, and we've got maybe an hour for a meeting that feels productive. And by hour 4 of everyone just like telling their opinions, everyone's tired, doesn't care, nothing happens, everyone moves on, everybody quits. So why I like Zen is we usually sit Sazen first. Everyone's hopefully a little bit less ego prone. And we're supposedly following a lineage. We're probably going to be innovating. Your ideas and your personality become the entire place is the idea. But it's just kind of in a different mindset. I hope I'm making sense. I didn't mean that to be my talk on emptiness, but that's my talk on emptiness.
I do a lot of, try and do a lot of audiobooks and read a lot of physics, like particle physics and like quantum physics. And the talking about like, this room wouldn't be here if we weren't in here is kind of like a theme that they talk about. Like, it's in a flux. You can never know the position or the velocity of a particle until you measure it. But once you measure it, it's like the whole, the tree fall in the forest, is anyone here kind of thing. I was also like Nagarjuna, like, do you ever read?
Yeah, we did the whole thing like, on
him.
Yeah,
the whole, I mean, I started, you know, listening to his thing, and it's like, what is this? It's like, it's pretty out there. It's like pretty gibberish. I mean, not gibberish, but it's just like, it's intense.
Nagarjuna's hard, because to me, it's really funny. Actually, there is a modern Western. I try not to mix Buddhism and science because I'm not a scientist. Yeah, yeah. And I've heard the scientists get very annoyed when do that.
Yeah.
But the poetry correlators are so there. I mean, quantum foam, like you're talking about, like it gets pretty. Anyway, a guy wrote a book. A scientist wrote, Lawrence Krauthammer wrote a great book. Krauss? Anyway, A Universe from Nothing. And he writes, it's a mathematical proof the universe doesn't exist. Which is hilarious, right? Because obviously, we're sitting here. But he can prove to you mathematically that it was born of nothing and still technically adds up to nothing. The Mula Madhya Mahakakarika, if I just said that right, the MMK, is Nagarjuna's logical proof that nothing exists. And the problem with it is, I'm sure it was hilarious and or very profound in its time and place, but it was a very different time and place.
Yeah.
Like, India had a whole culture around, it was a royal and academic debate culture that had, like, rules, traditions, consequences, like, well, sometimes life or death consequences, you lost those debates. And so what Nagarjuna had to do was to demonstrate the Buddhist corollary of emptiness. He had to prove against all possible challenges that emptiness was the ultimate. So he then writes the MMK in a very specific format to demonstrate to that court that nothing can ever be said to exist in and of itself. So that's what that is. So it's hard for us to read in context.
Yeah.
As a thing, it's hilarious, but you were not going to get the joke the way it was written.
But is it like, is that kind of like talking about the same emptiness?
Yeah. And especially in Indian Buddhism, Nagarjuna was a huge figure. They kind of start a lot of Mahayana Buddhism. It was not historically true, but he becomes like kind of the patron figure of Mahayana Buddhism, especially with the emptiness and the Prajnaparamita Sutras. They don't attribute them to him. I think the legends go that Nagarjuna got the Prajnaparamita Sutras from snake gods living in the water, but they were probably written long before that. But that's how important he was to the tradition, is that that's where they place him. Yeah.
I know you always say things like, you're not a scientist, so we can't speak to it. And there's some validity because we do need to study and it takes a lot of years of research. However, Da Vinci was what? A philosopher, a scientist. For me, when we talk about reality and nothingness and all that, I can't help but think about physics and the multiverse. And it's taking away from the poetics, but I don't mean to because I love that part about it. But the one thing I do disagree, like depending on the internal workings, you could either let it take you to a path of enlightenment, of kindness, or you could let it like bastardize you and you can say, well, because I am this smart and I comprehend these very deep concepts, that it could let some people be kind of assholey as well. And I've lived with people who are like, use yoga, like yoga makes me a better person, yet they were really, really shady people who did really awful things. So I think that happens through a lot of these spiritual, like Eastern practice, that some people do bastardize them. So we still need to do the work of emotional intelligence and hopefully follow things in the right direction.
Yeah, I think one thing it's important to, like, we generally have theories, but what I like about the way they're emphasizing this is that they don't usually care if their theories are correct. And I've often seen, like, so I skipped over the part about skillful means. Skillful means is a very interesting term in Mahayana Buddhism, where in some sutras it almost seems to imply that Buddhists say, I will basically say anything if it gets you to, quote unquote, the truth. Implying that he said things that were not quite entirely true before because they had the effect of. So everything we're doing is, I think the academic word would be praxis. I skipped over the language part a bit too. But they say language, at least in terms, in practical terms, language is a huge problem because it's where we name and define things. And that's where we make things static. And so this is more of a practice thing where we're kind of letting go of that kind of way. So anything that can pry open those kind of like set things to allow you to be flexible and open. So like, yeah, I think your example is actually a perfect example. I have seen exactly what you're talking about. I've seen people who, I'll be very honest. I was very anti-Dogen for a long time because the people who would read me Dogen often seemed to have kind of a snooty air about it. They would say things they didn't understand and seemed to enjoy the fact that they knew something that I didn't know. And it was the cold intellectual thing that was kind of used to like lord over people a lot of places. And then I actually read Dogen. I was like, oh, but this is actually great. Because what Dogen's actually doing is, it's baffling, but it's supposed to open you up. Anyway, so what is kindness? Kindness is being, usually it's being open to somebody where they're at. Real kindness, as far as I understand, real compassion is dropping your knees on what somebody else needs to be to and being with them in that situation. That was my training around what we were trained to do, which requires letting go of your ideas sometimes of right and wrong, of what's best for this person that you can't actually possibly know. And so in Buddhist terms, real kindness is dropping conceptions, being present, doing the right thing, however that appears in the moment, which you don't know until you're there. And so that's why it's kind of taught as like, drop the preconceptions. Because yeah, we're trying to avoid the, I know Dogen, you don't know. Practice Dogen. Be present. That's more the idea.
Now, I just want to say thank you. It's wonderful to hear you share your experience and thought. That guy sometimes jokingly says, I feel like that's a social worker. Kind of getting, but one thing I do feel, as you were talking about darkness and light, mm-hmm. this is, I personally differentiate lay and monks. Mm. And because you're talking about lay leadership of this Zen, I mean, I have community up in Canada too, and I often contemplate on that. With lay people, I allow them to dwell on the light. In the monastics, I will not tolerate to let them, I would not let me move people move forward on behalf of Soto Zen school. And this is my responsibility to not to let people move forward when they're dwelling on the light. Because you radiate that darkness, you know, that subtlety. And I do feel like an artist who can create a beautiful art, but I know what the good art work is. So because thanks to the exposure to all these teachers, and so, and I just wanted to acknowledge, you know, recognize that you're moving forward for a very good reason. Mm-hmm. And I'm not just saying this personally, but because the school knows that that's what we value, that darkness radiating. And then, I don't know, I just kind of want to ask for your insight on, because actually I'm applying for both AZT, American Zen Teachers Association, that includes Vietnamese and Korean and Rinzai Zen teacher. But also interested in applying for Lay Soto Zen Teachers Association in the U.S. How these people are, as if I borrow your word, like, what was that word? Like, just, what was that?
Fuck around.
Yeah. How they're actually trying to kind of pave the way forward for this. Because in my mind, that's where that, you know, the dualities, right and wrong, light, you know, agendas, social structures, this is what I believe is right, political views. I kind of accept that among lay people. And that's why it gets messy sometimes.
Well, to have a conversation in front of everybody, what I see from this group is that when we tell them monastic lay difference, where it's like, well, it seems like people want at least some of the full thing you would give to monastics. They don't want the light lay version entirely. But also, when they say it's going to be frustrating, it's going to be upsetting, I see people get frustrated and upset too. And so I'm kind of having a lot of fun seeing how that plays out. You know, it's like, okay, this is the truth as it was hounded down. It's not pretty and it doesn't make sense. And people are like, this isn't pretty, doesn't make sense. And it's like, I know, that's what you asked for. That's what we're selling. And so to me, there's a grand experiment happening. So when we're going to create structures, let's like, can we put elements of that into it? Or should we just be a little bit more clear and stable? I don't know. We're going to fuck around and find out.
Thank you.
Thanks, Joke.
I have a more technical question about Zazen. And why do we have our eyes open? And is it supposed to be kind of half closed? Or, I mean, half open, fully open?
Yes. No, that's a great question. Yeah. The eyes open... Again, as I said in this stuff, they didn't tell me why a lot of things. I've inferred a lot of whys along the way. My understanding of the eyes open thing is that if you close your eyes, it's real easy to get lost doing internal stuff. Since, you know, like we say, Zazen is much more focused on being present and not trying to create internal mystical feeling states And the eyes open helps keep us like present and grounded. It's a wall, we're here. So it's just a way of staying alert and present like that. As far as how to hold your eyes, the problem with being an hour sitting somewhere, a half hour, is you can overthink anything, especially things like that. I've been taught like half open. I've seen a lot of people, I'll be honest, like people all over the place do it differently. I've seen some places where they say half open, their eyes are clearly like pretty much just closed, like they're letting on a sliver of light. I always think whatever it is that you're not worried about it, that's the right amount of open. So if you're like staring at the wall, like intently, like looking for cracks, too much, you know? If you're like glazing out and it's going gray and you can't really see, you know, be present. And after a while, you probably won't worry about it anymore. Is that helpful?
Yeah, totally.
Sweet. And it's 9 o'clock. We did it. Good talk, y'all. That one, that I like where that talk went. I like that Gyokei approves of Fuck Around to Find Out. We might actually call the podcast that now. I was worried about that and got that one over well.